Accession number 9927, Reel 7.
Lieutenant Colonel Hemsley, Reel 7. I think you went into the signals at some stage, and I wonder if you could tell me how that fitted into the Battle of Messines.
Well, what really happened, before the Battle of Messines, we were out of the line on rest period, and as usually was the case, a certain amount of opportunity was given to talks and instructions, and one particular day it was a major from the Royal Engineer Signals to talk to the troops about signals and how they worked. At the end of the talk, I went forward to the major and said, I, of course, am a telephone man. I'm the test clerk at Croydon. Whereupon he said, well, what are you doing here? We can do with you in signals. He said, I will arrange for you to be transferred. So I went away very comforted by this, thought all will be well. But nothing happened. I went back up the line, down from the line. Then they said, we're preparing for the Battle of Messines. And I said, well, thank goodness I shan't be concerned with that. But I found I was. It got nearer and nearer, and finally I found myself in the battle, and no more thoughts about signals. But when it was over, at that stage came this precious instruction that Second Lieutenant Hemsley was to leave the infantry and go to the signal school at Mount Cassel and be tested for training there. So I left and went straight to the signal school. Now, then we come back to the fact that I had therefore been in the Battle of Messines, didn't we?
Indeed, yes. But I wonder if you could tell me now about your experience, you know, at training at Mount Cassel.
Oh, yes, that's mighty interesting.
Yes.
My instructions were for Second Lieutenant Hemsley was to report to the signal school at Cassel and go through a course to thus prove that he'll be of value to signals. Well, when I arrived there, they said, how the army messes things up, we're only halfway through our course. I said, well, may I go to the second half and perhaps you'll let me take the examination? Oh, yes, you can do if you like that. A very nice signals officer talking to me about this. So I sat down and joined him with these people. My astonishment, I knew more about it than any of them. None of them were telephone men, you see. They were from the infantry in different parts. And so I said, shall I sit for the examination? I haven't had the course yet. We can if you like. So I sat for the examination. I came out top, which wasn't surprising. Nobody else was a telephone man there. And I said, will you kindly tear those up? I don't want to miss my course. And so then I started off the 6 weeks course, you see. Well, again, of course, at the end, I came out pretty well on the top, which was easy for me. I must assure you that it was only because I was a telephone man and the others were not.
Yes, how did the work you were doing in the army, how did this sort of relate to your work in civilian life? You know, were the signals much the same?
Well, they were of a much simpler nature. But mind you, they were all the time building up. I remember the excitement on the discovery of the wireless valve, and we'd taken a box with a wireless valve sticking from it, and this was looked upon with great interest, and we stood it underneath the overhead army lines, and to our surprise and alarm we could hear every word going along, thing we never would have dreamt of before. And so this showed us that this new wireless valve was going to be amazingly important, and of course it was. As time went on, it became part of the army's equipment. But that was the first time I'd ever heard of it, or we'd ever known of the fact that it could be done.
So this would be 1917, would it? when that
happened? Yes, probably early 17, that would be that, yes.
Mm. So when was wireless incorporated into signals at the front, do you think? By the time, you know, was it before the end of the war that they'd got
I on? I should think so, yes. We must have been using it before the end of the war. Though my side of the signals was, I can't come to it at the present moment because we're going to talk about a fairly lengthy period going through the Australian Corps side of it. But
I'm just wondering what technology you would be using, you see.
Personally, I was definitely a normal land telephone man. I've been the test clerk at Croydon Exchange, and as such, that had been my side. I had taken the various certificates of City and Guilds in the telephony and telegraphy, and that was my business, really. And so once I got away from the infantry, I was more or less at home in the signals. And we got to get the... I'd like to talk about...
We'll get to your jobs at the front, and then you can explain the signals you were using. I think that would be the best approach, don't mm-hmm. you? So what was the first section you were sent to? Could you tell me about that, having done your signals training in 1917?
Now, this is where we get to... Move it on or what? When I had finished my training at the signal school and had passed out in comfort, I was then available for posting. And at that time, the colonel commanding the signals in the Australian Corps, as a full colonel, known as Deputy Director of Signals to the Australians, required a young officer as a secretary. And it would appear that I must have been available for that job, because as a post office man and a telephone man, I should know something about it. And so I found myself a very small member of the staff of General Burwood and the Australian Corps. And we were in a wonderful old chateau, and I sat there most days at my desk beside the old colonel and organised his day.
This was Colonel... What was the name of your colonel?
Powell, P-O-W-E-L-L. I won't tell you too much about him, but anyway, he was, to me, quite friendly and glad to have someone to do things for him. And he was difficult to approach, and therefore when various officers wanted to get a couple of days of leave, go into the back end of the town and enjoy their lives, they would have to get his permission, and he was very difficult. And the only way to do was to know what he was like, and so we had a scheme by which I would look out of the window and I'd see one of my junior officer friends there, and I would either say yes or no, you see. If it was yes, he'd come over and knock and come in, and the old colonel would say, well, what do you want? And he'd say, could I have 2 days? I feel I need 2 days. My foot is hurting, or some silly thing like that. And the old boy would sign it, you see. But if, on the other hand, they were foolish enough to walk in without checking with me first, he'd bail them out again just as quickly. So that you can see, you can imagine he was not easy to live with, but I had a very comfortable time with him. He used to upset the officers, because I remember the first time I went into the mess there, and we were all sitting round, and the colonel came in and he said, my wife sent us all a cake. So I said, isn't that good, you know? And so we started eating this cake and so on. And I couldn't quite understand why they weren't quite happy about it. And one of them said to me after, said, you know what happens? The old boy tells the secretary to charge that cake up on our bills, so we have to pay for it. He was a very mean gentleman. But apart from that, he was a very nice man to work for, really. And I went all over France with him in some of his runs. And then eventually he was moved back to London. And in due course I found another job. But the point is that while I was under his control, he suddenly turned to me and he said, these Australians, we keep getting pigeons to send to them and they keep eating them instead of using them for messengers. And he said, we shall have to have a signal school, a pigeon flying signal school. He said, go and do it. So I said, I don't know anything about pigeons. He said, well, now's a chance. So you'll soon find out. So you go to one of the old lofts and get some information. So I went into Bayeux. I arranged to take over a big empty house there. We arranged for the Australian officers and certain men to come in for a week's training in the messenger signal service. And I had a lovely notice board painted as big as this, you know, Australian Corps Signal Service. So that was rather a dangerous thing because I'd only just got going with it when the Major General of the Australian Staff, Major General White, was driving by and saw my impressive board, you see. So he came in time to watch me or listen to me giving my lesson on pigeons, you see, and their flying. And it was my first lesson. Had been rather terrible because I had a basket of pigeons and I took a pigeon from it and I put the message on the pigeon and showed the troops how to do it. But of course my first pigeon didn't like it and left me. It flew round and round the room, so I said, well, open the window and let him go. So he went and I had to do it all over again. Now, when General White came and looked on, I was in great style with this pigeon, you see, and he said, I must get General Burbu to come round and see this. This will please him, I'm sure. So a good thing. So the next morning, sure enough, General Burbu drove up in his car and his staff, they came stamping in there and I was giving my story. And so he looked at me and I said, this, sir, is one of our messenger birds. He took it from my hand. He said, oh, yes, a very nice blue pie. He said, I've been a pigeon fancier for years. He knew far more about pigeons than I ever did. However, that was an interesting meeting from him. So I ran this pigeon school for some time. Everybody liked it. The officers had a jolly evening in the town, you see, and the men liked it as well. They didn't care about the pigeons, but I think we probably had less of them being eaten on the way when they got up there. So that was a good start, and then another day.
Were they effective, though, pigeons, you know, as a means of flying?
Most remarkable. They came 40 miles an hour straight from the front, and well, of course, you see, you always sent either two males or two females, you see. Never a male or female, otherwise they merely stopped and made a home somewhere and bred. But they always came back because they'd all got, especially the females, a pair of good females were the very best thing to send because they'd got squabs behind that they were feeding in the loft. And they'd come back at 40 miles an hour from the front line. They'd jump into the trap. The moment they step on the trap, it rang a bell. The pigeon mare was there beside in the tent or wherever he's living, rushed in, took the bird out, put it into took her off this message, you see, and then he'd ring up and the dispatch rider would rush this to the intelligence. And then the intelligence would read this message, some of it quite interesting perhaps, that they'd been able to pick up. And
Was there fear of German shooting the pigeons down, you know? Could that have happened?
They could do, but I don't know that it's very important. That would happen where one strayed. The danger, of course, if it flew wrongly, and they always go round and round, you see, if at that stage they possibly could shoot one down, of course they'd get the message from it. The message might not be very vital, though, because what they did with the pigeons, they always sent them off by the second day with a message of some kind, if only just to say we're all well at home, that, you see. But that fetched the pigeons back, the very fact that they got their squabs waiting for them. And we got some very useful messages coming back at that time too.
Would the messages have been in code, any mate? Do you know if they were written in code?
No, they wouldn't. They'd be just from officer giving minor information or asking for something, you see. But what did happen was we also, is later on, we had listening posts with wireless equipment and picking up the messages from the Germans in our listening posts. Now, one thing that could happen there is that the listening post would send their messages that they'd got from the Germans into the nearest man with pigeons in the front line, and then it would finish up, they'd come back on the pigeons. And then, of course, it would be hurriedly dispatched by dispatch rider from the pigeons to intelligence. Anyway, that was my entrance and eventual ending of the pigeon service, as far as I was concerned, because the next thing was the old colonel turned to me and he said, "Hemsley, it's dogs this time." I said, "Dogs?" He said, "Yes. The headquarters are going to send 48 dogs with the men that go with three dogs to a man, and you've got to deal with them." So I went to the little village Vinacore, found some ground there, had it wired in, put my dog men in there with their dogs. Whereupon the mayor of Vinacore came and complained bitterly because they barked all night and kept there all the village awake. So I had to uplift them from there and put them well away in the woods where there were no trouble to anybody. They were a very happy crowd there. They fed the dogs on fresh cut horse meat, from generally from horses killed in battle and so on, you see. And they gave the dogs the odd bits, but actually the steaks, they all ate themselves. And they were always, when I'd visit them, they'd have beautiful steaks frying on the fire in front of me. Say, "Would you like a steak?" And I said, "No, thanks." But they always wanted me to eat some of their dogs' horse meat. The dogs were quite useful too. They were taken up the line, of course, and a message put on them, and then it's like, "Off you go home," and they'd come back to their handler, who was waiting for them at the headquarters for them to come back. One of the big problems there was the Englishman's love of dogs. They would try to stop the dogs on their way back when passing through the gun lines. The gunners would come out and give them meat and that kind of thing and delay them. We had much difficulty. We made that they had a blue and white collar, and the orders were quite strict that no one was to touch them, but it was terribly difficult. I had a beautiful dog, Bob, which was a German one we captured. And he was a delightful pet and went everywhere. He was very well trained too, and it was a German dog.
Was there any particular type of dog which was very good at this job, you know, better than others?
Well, the best jobs were the particular variety of German dog, and the Germans only used that one variety. But our dog groups were taken from Battersea Dogs Home of all shapes and sizes, not little ones, but they could be a collie or they could be a retriever, and half a dozen. Any large dog was good enough. I don't think they had greyhounds because they're rather delicate. But the dogs, they were lovely animals. When I went in there, they were a complete bedlam, of course, all 48 of them barking at once. And I'd go round and see the dog, and their men loved them very much. But I had one particularly serious trouble with the dogs, and that is that I got everything organised when a very senior colonel came down from the headquarters and said, "I've come down to see your dog business. We hear it's interesting." And I said, "Well, they're out at the moment, but they're all coming back from the brigades this afternoon. We've sent the lorry around to collect them. They'll be here in a minute." Now, on their way back, they went through one of the towns that had been very severely bombed and battered, and the men's outfitting shop had been shot right out into the street. This dog group of mine, that was about six men, there'd be 18 dogs, wasn't it, all tucked in this big lorry, and they stopped in this town, and they all helped themselves to bright coloured velour hats that had landed out in the street from the men's shop. And so I said to this very senior colonel standing beside me, I said, "The lorry's just coming in, sir. The men will be taking the dogs out." And they dropped the back of this lorry, and out came this group of clowns with these funny coloured hat, purple hats and so on. And this senior colonel was very offensive to me about it. He said, "Is that the way you train your men?" Because they're quite incorrigible, these chaps. Their one job was dogs, you see. They're not much good for anything else. But it was one of those moments which didn't help me very much.
What other methods did you use for, you know, I suppose you had runners as well, did you?
For what?
For delivering messages, you would have had runners.
Oh, you mean, Oh, yes, they were running. Well, they weren't any connected with signals. The infantry would send their own messages back by their own runners. They did have their own runners too, I agree. No, we were only concerned with messages that came back by dog or by pigeon, but we didn't supply the runners otherwise. They were, that was the male side that had to do itself. But
So your work with this ANZAC Corps, the first ANZAC Corps,
yes.
Why were you, as a Brit...
why was I there?
Yes, why were you seconded to the ANZACs?
The point really was this, that the ANZACs were formed from the three divisions of 1st, 2nd and 3rd ANZAC divisions, and that required more senior headquarters to it, and so they supplied English officers to completely cover the headquarters and various other jobs, and gradually they were being taken away and replaced by Australians. But in a question of months doing this, you see, and so I found myself at the headquarters of the Australian with an English colonel in command and with English good post office telegraphists, as our men there, you see.
And could I also establish quite clearly the area you were working in at that time, when you were with General Birdwood in France?
Well, we were at a chateau near Bayeux in France.
That would have been your headquarters.
And that was our headquarters. We had huts in the garden of the chateau for our own offices, you see. We didn't live at headquarters, we lived in the village.
And these messages that you were responsible for, what sort of lines were they being received from and sent to? You know, was it battalion, brigade, division?
It would be from battalion to brigades we shouldn't see much of. They'd stop at brigade. Now, this would be the more senior messages coming from brigades and divisions to the corps headquarters, you see. There'd be a fair amount of paperwork there, quite a lot of work, and we have the signal office was then manned with English troops and officers. But
so what would your work have been, you know, apart from handling the pigeons or organising the dogs?
But when I was actually then at the headquarters, well, with pigeon and dogs and so on, this was only a sideline. I was still the colonel's secretary, and I was still in the colonel's office normally. Then I went off to my signal school, or else I went off to see how my dogs were. That was only part of my general responsibility, you see. And I had that for some time, really. But one by one, the English officers were withdrawn and replaced by experienced, trained Australian officers coming out from Australia. And so it went on. We said goodbye to this one, said goodbye to this one. My nice major went, everybody went. And there was the colonel and I, about all that was left with the Australians. And then came the message for the colonel to go. And so the colonel said, Hemsley, I'm going to go down such as a station now, I'll take you with me. And when we got there, he said, I'm going to pay for your lunch, a thing he'd never done before. And gave me out lunch, and then I said goodbye to the colonel, whom I never met again. And at that stage, I was made more or less an Australian. By that I mean I was the only Englishman, English officer on the Australian headquarters signals. Very nice fellows. I got to be very friendly with the colonel there. And then...
I can't quite establish what you were doing, though. You know, you say you were in the office, but, you know, was this secretarial work, or were you... You know, I can't really understand...
Not paperwork from that point of view, because they'd have clerks, you see, army clerks. No, my job was to take messages for the old gentleman, to keep him supplied with information, or go off to find out what he wanted to know, or even go to the other officers around to obtain information for him. In other words, I was just a useful sort of dog's body to do work for you know, under his control. Nobody else was my boss except him. One by one, the Australians took over until there was nobody left of the English except me.
How did you get on with the Australians? Yes.
Oh, marvellous. They're wonderful people. Later on, when I was up in the push, right up in the line, to when I'd finished this rather interesting headquarter job, they sent me down right into the front area to take over an underground lines where we were running right the way through for the Passchendaele battles. And I had my own spot there, and I lived there night and day. I slept there, and it was in a tin hut with earth and leather over the top against shell fire.
Can you remember what position it would have been in the Ypres area? Was it quite near Passchendaele Ridge? No, opposite.
Opposite might be the right term, but well back, if you like, from that area. There are so many little towns there. There was Renninghouse, there was Wichy, there was Mount Cassel, all these places. Well, it might be on that map of yours, some of them. And
But you were in that sort of area?
Yes. I can't give you the exact spot, but it was in that area.
Yes, no, that's fine. It establishes where you were.
Yes.
And this would have been in the summer, would it, of 1917?
Yes, it would then. When they were preparing for the Passchendaele battle, and I was... I was then made the forward lines officer, and I was in this dugout night and day keeping the communications going through there. All our cables were brought in at that point, and at night I managed to walk into Ypres and help myself to some of the furniture out of the battered houses, so that my little place was so attractive with its comforts there and the chairs and so on that I used to get senior officers coming to visit me, and they're so intrigued with me up in the line in this little home of my own. But there was a particularly nice major in the Army Signals, the Australian Signals, and at night time he always felt that I must be a bit lonely, which I might easily have been, and he would ring me up and say, one of us has just been to England. We've been to see Toronto. Chin Chow, and we'd like you to hear some of the music. He would then start this gramophone record and put the receiver beside it, and I'd sit back there listening to all lovely music I hadn't heard before and so on. It was very delightful. He did that for some weeks at intervals, calling me at night and giving me this. That was the kind of friendly people they were. The same way that when I went to visit New Zealanders, they discovered a pastry cook somewhere who turned out beautiful cream pastries, and to go and visit the New Zealanders, we were all right in their mess. You really had good cakes and things, although you were just in a dugout.
Could I now ask you more about manning the forward lines for the Passchendaele battle? How forward were these? I'm wondering where the lines would have been placed in relation to the frontline trench and the reserve trenches. Where would they have been
positioned? Well, I think that the furthest the underground lines would be to the brigade headquarters. From there onwards, it's wires across the ground, you see, to reach them, and they get very frequently cut, and so you had the trouble of having to continually put them in order. As far as possible, we managed to push our cable lines further and further. But what happened there was that before the battle, they allocated to two officers, signals officer, one a nice young man, but a little senior to me, both of us second lieutenants, and we were given orders to lay the cables right out for Passchendaele, right as far forward as we were ordered, and each day one of us would go out and run long white tapes where the trenches were to go. And then that night, with the entire battalion of the New Zealand Rifles, we would go along, allocate these men and tell them to start digging. And they'd got to dig down about at least 4 feet before we could put the cable there. The cable in the daytime, we'd had that carried up, two men with one roll of cable taken up there in readiness. And we had to stand on the top of this trench, which unfortunately, of course, it was uncomfortable when it was shelling, because the others, the more they dug, the safer they were. And I presume I must have jumped in there occasionally when it was getting too bad. But anyway, when we got it finally finished, we'd got all these cables running back in readiness for the battle, and they allocated a military cross, which I quite rightly consider gave to the senior of the two men. Although we both of us did the same job, it was only one medal for the job, you see. So good luck to him, he got it, I didn't.